Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello, welcome to the next edition of These Football Times Weekly Pod. Aidan Williams, I'm here with a couple of regulars this time to join me and to chew the fat on all things football, current and coming up. I've got Gary Thacker with me tonight. How are you doing there, Gary?
Well, I've got a bit of a cold, Aidan. I can't believe it. I live in Perish in spite of all this sunshine. It's been ridiculously hot. I'm suffering with a perishing cold, but aside from that, I'm good. Got to talk about football with my mate Sunday evening.
Good stuff, good stuff. Well, you're not the only one with a cold. My voice is slightly hampered, but, you know, I live in a slightly colder place, as you can tell by the woolly jumper. Gary's in a T-shirt. Also here tonight is Paul McParlin. How are you doing there, Paul?
I'm fine, Aidan, Gary. I'm delighted I haven't got a cold as yet, so I'm feeling a bit left out of this club at the moment. But, yeah, I think we're all quite jealous of Gary and his sunnier climes there. And Gary's meant to ask you, have the clocks gone back in Spain this weekend?
Yes, they have,
well?
Yeah. It's exactly the same, yeah. Okay. We're an hour in front, but they've both come back at the same time, so just an hour in front still, yeah.
Because I guess in Newcastle gets dark about 2 in the afternoon now, doesn't it?
Oh, yes. You don't live in the North Pole.
You live in the
Midlands, pretty much. You know, that's not the North. This is the North. Anyway, on that note, let's get things cracking. Let's start with a bit of sunshine, then, Gary. Why don't you kick us off tonight?
Okay, I'm going to kick you off, and I'm going to throw a bit of sunshine down on you, Aidan. Here, I want to talk about Newcastle and particularly Eddie Howe. When the takeover came into sort of force, and they're talking about all this. They're going to spend, I don't know, crazy money on bringing Messi and Neymar and Mbappe and Benzema and whoever else you want to mention into the club. And they appointed Eddie Howe. I just thought, you know, these guys, these world stars, aren't even attracted by a guy called Eddie Howe. They've never heard of him. He used to manage Bournemouth. But I have to say, the club's done magnificently. I was looking at some details today, and I know Isaac's out at the moment. There's, I think, was the record signing, but in the summer transfer window, they spent half as much as Chelsea, £20 million less than Nottingham Forest, and roughly about the same as Wolves spent. And look how well they're playing now. I mean, they've got players performing. Dan Burnley, I think they got from Bournemouth. Fabian Shaw, they brought in. It was okay, he's an international player, but you know, you're not going to put him in the top 10 centre-backs in the world. Miguel Almirón, he's playing like Pelé at the moment. I mean, just think, Eddie Howe's done a fantastic job with Newcastle. And although, you know, the talk was going to spend massive amounts of money and become the richest club in the world, they haven't spent that much. And look where they are in the league. I just think Eddie Howe's done a fantastic job with Newcastle United. Over to you, buddy. There's a smile.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, we can't deny there has been... So you're quoting figures over the summer there, Gary. Obviously, there was a fair bit of spend in January as well. So I can't deny there's been a fair amount of spending. Part of that, we can thank Mike Ashley for not having spent money for years and years. So we're not falling into any financial fair play traps because there's a fair bit of available spend there. Yeah, it'll be interesting how it continues. But I think you're right. They brought in quality. I think in terms of those that have come in that have been absolute quality, Trippier has made a massive, massive difference just around the club as well as his own abilities. Bruno Guimarães, obviously, as well. He's a level above the rest of them, I think, in terms of quality and ability. Beyond that, you're absolutely right to highlight some of those who weren't so great before. You know, Fabian Scher wasn't really getting much of a look in as a centre back. He's now sort of alongside Botman, another good signing. Is proven his worth. Dan Burn is remarkable for someone who nobody else was particularly after him. He was just thrilled to be able to come and play for his hometown club. But yeah. Joel Linton, last season, his transformation in a fairly short space of time from hapless, hopeless striker, you know, not really suitable for that role at all in the Premier League whatsoever. No confidence at all. It just felt a bit sorry for the guy. It was a bit of a joke. But his transformation into sort of destructive midfield, box-to-box destroyer, scoring a goal at this weekend as well with a little bit of following up a Wilson shot and poaching. it's absolutely remarkable what's happened to him. It's astonishing. You never would have believed from the previous 2 or 3 years of fairly inept performances where this had come from. And then Almiron, again, you know, he suffered Jack Grealish's jibes over the summer of, you know, if you want to slag someone off, you say they played a bit like Almiron. Well, Jack Grealish would love to be playing like Almiron.
I mean, I think Joe Linton's a great example. I mean, this guy, as a striker, looked like Cuddy's a barn door with a banjo. And all of a sudden, as you say, he's become, you know, Frank Lampard-esque midfield player. I just think how
he's
done.
Well, he seems to prefer it. He seems to prefer it, yeah. It's odd. You kind of think a striker or a forward player wouldn't take too kindly to being repurposed as a midfielder. They kind of feel slightly jilted at that, you know. Strikers like the glory, forward players, they want to be scoring, creating the chances and all of that. But he seems to be absolutely relishing it. If you offered him the chance to become a striker again, I don't think he'd want to. I think he's loving it so much. And he's become, this is the stuff cult heroes are made of, isn't it? This is how you become a cult hero, you know, the transformation. And just enjoying your role and loving it so much. And Almiron, too, is a bit of a cult hero because, yeah, again, he couldn't hit a barn door with a banjo either. But then he's found his form in pre-season this year, and now he can't stop scoring, and he can't stop scoring spectacular goals as well. Another terrific one at the weekend against Villa. He scored 6 this month alone.
Yeah.
This month? This is astonishing.
He's doing his own goal of the month competition, apparently. I mean, you signed a goalkeeper from Burnley. I mean, you know, don't get me wrong, Nick Pope's more than a decent goalkeeper, but if you become the richest club in the world, you know, your fans probably aren't expecting to sign a goalkeeper from Burnley. I just think, you know, the club has done magnificently well, and the coaching of Eddie Howe, the way he's inspired these players, Joe Linton, you say Almiron, Callum Wilson, just been amazing. Amazing success for the club, and I'll say for Eddie Howe in particular.
Yeah, totally. You got it. I think as well, I think what Howard's done really well is he's brought players to fit into a team rather than bringing superstars in with egos and stuff like that. He's brought players who would gel. You mentioned Dan Burns there, Aidan. What a great sign that was. You're bringing back a local Geordie lad to play into the team. His passion for the club shines through in every game that he plays. You mentioned Burnley there, Gary. You know, he brings in Chris Wood as like a backup forward who offers a plan B if plan A doesn't work, if the silky stuff doesn't work. Well, you can go back to plan B. You know, that gives defences another headache to cope with as well. Look at Newcastle's defence this season. Newcastle now got the best defence in the Premier League. Now, who would ever have thought that Eddie Howe would have a team with the best defence in the Premier League?
Who'd ever have thought any Newcastle side would? That's all I can think.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of gone under the radar a little bit. You know, you mentioned Nick Pope there as well, Gary. An outstanding goalkeeper. You know, no frills. You get a 90% performance from every week. You know, you can rely on him. Doesn't make howlers like Hugo Lloris and people like that. You know, he's consistent week in, week out. I was reading about Eddie Howe as well. I mean, when he was at the game for 15 months, he apparently spent his time going to other clubs and seeing how they worked and training. He spent some time with Diego Simeone, and I'm sure he picked up some defensive tactics and advice from watching how Atletico perform under him as well. So he's used that time well. I think there were some question marks about him having been out the game for 15 months, whether, you know, he'd been out too long, whether his chance had gone. But I think he's waiting for the right job. And he didn't make the best of starts, did he, Aidan? Because he got beat at home by Cambridge in the FA Cup. And sadly, I hate to say this, the game that starts Newcastle's revival is when he beat us 2-1. Last season, that was the first league win, and things went up from then. I mean, Newcastle lost one game this season, and they were absolutely cheesed out of that by Klopp time when there's 5 minutes stoppage time, but somehow you play on to Liverpool score. It's a common thing at Anfield, apparently. And if had been for that, Newcastle would have been unbeaten this season. So Newcastle in the top four, only lost one game, got the best defence in the Premier League, got goal scorers all over the team. You know, it's I know there's often been bubbles burst at Newcastle, particularly in the Keegan years, but I just think Eddie Howe has done an absolutely fantastic job, as Gary said, and I think we're quite right to sing his praises on the show.
Let's not forget, though, he was second choice as well. The guy who was first choice is now just pitched up at Aston Villa.
Yeah.
And he was going to get the job, Unai Emery. That was dusted until he backed out at the last minute. So, you know, how different might things have been? It'll be interesting to see how he gets on at Aston Villa in comparison. He's got a job on his hands after looking at the second half yesterday of how they Newcastle were all over him. I mean, it was, yeah, that would be interesting to see.
I think his first decision, quite simply, is to get rid of Tyrone Mings. I've never seen such an appalling defender. And if he ends up going to Qatar with England, well, I just give up completely.
I mean, just cap it off. If somebody said at the start of the season, Newcastle United are going to fully realistic Champions League contenders to qualification, people would have turned it down. But the smile on Aidan's face suggests, they're in with every chance. I mean, as you say, lost one game, lost a season, they're in with every chance, scoring loads of goals, best defensive record. They're the surprise package of the Premier League for me. And as Paul says, and more power to Eddie Howe. And if Southgate goes after England's World Cup, it's got to be in pole position to get the job, which probably won't be much of a comfort to Newcastle fans. But, I mean, he's just... It was just a pretty bang ordinary manager in my mind. I've been proved wrong. No problem admitting it. He's done brilliantly.
Yeah, it's quite a transformation. I mean, I will add, I'm still rather... not sceptical, just... what's the right word? I don't know. It doesn't all sit well with me.
I think you expressed that view quite well, didn't you, when we talked about this last season after the takeover?
Exactly, yeah. It's not quite like it was under Keegan. There's the galvanising effect of performances, the City feeling up. Yes, there's all of that the same, but, I'm not one of those you can just ignore where it's all come from. And it doesn't sit that well with me. However, I probably imagine I'm in the minority because... Well, as with many football fans of many clubs, you just ignore that side of things.
Sit back and enjoy the ride, buddy.
I'll do my best. Yeah. I'll do my best.
Aidan, what's been so reassuring watching Newcastle this season? Every time I watched Newcastle previously, the main playmaker has been John Joe Shelby, who's the slowest player in the Premier League. So the fact that he's not even getting a game now just shows the progress that you've made.
Yeah, definitely. It's all about Bruno. It's all about Bruno. We do talk about Bruno when it comes to Newcastle United. There you go.
I understood that remark. I've got to crack towards those four, so I understand that remark.
Good. I'm glad I wasn't just saying it to absolutely nobody.
Yeah, okay, buddy. I got you.
Paul, how about your topic for this week then?
Yeah, so I always like to think, can football learn from other sports? So, like you this week, Aidan, I had the chance of going to see the Rugby League World Cup. So, I went to a game at St. Helens, which is a group game between Tonga and Wales. And I was just kind of comparing the two experiences, thinking, is there anything we can learn from another sport that could improve the experience for the spectator of football? And a couple of kind of random observations crossed my mind. First thing was, as I walked to the ground, I bought a programme, the World Cup programme, £6. That's fine because I went to a League One playoff final 3 years ago between Rotherham and Shrewsbury and I had to pay £10 for the programme. So I thought, well, a World Cup over £6, that's fine. I've got no problem with that, I would go into the grounds, go to the bar, all the couple of beers, and I just said to the girl behind the bar, so do we have to drink the beers here? Oh, no, you can take them through. So I kind of did double take. I can take them through to watch the game. Yeah, no problem. So going through, I'm there in the stadium, beer in the hand, and guess what? I don't turn into a raving lunatic. I don't start shouting abuse themselves ever. I sit there and I watch and enjoy the game and I look around and other people are going through that same experience. So once again, I'm thinking, why can't I do this at a football game? It's absolute madness. And then during the game as well, I don't know what you two think at the moment. I just find watching football at the moment, particularly in the last 5 or 10 minutes of a game, there are so many constant stoppages with substitutions, with players falling down injured. It really does destroy the flow of the game for me. And two things I noticed from the rugby game was, one, you don't stop for substitutions. Substitutions are made while the play is going on. I'm looking at this thing. This is brilliant because the play doesn't stop. The announcer over the town is just in what change is being made. There's none of this stopping, clapping the fans, taking 2 minutes to walk off the pitch. The game continues. I just thought the game flowed constantly. Secondly, I'm looking at injuries. Now, I'm seeing guys getting clobbered by 6 foot 16 stone players knocked to the ground. And they're not rolling around in agony, putting their head in their hands, screaming for a penalty or something to be awarded. They're just getting on with it. And I thought, this is just such a change to watch the attitude. I was really looking at the officials to see how does VAR work in this system. And what I hadn't realised was the way it works in rugby league apparently is VAR can't overrule the referee. Once the referee's made the decision stands. But the referee can ask VAR's assistance if they're not sure about the decision that they've made. So they've awarded the try, but they're not quite sure. Just want to check for him if it goes to VAR. the game I was watching, but there were about 7 VAR referrals. I don't think any decision took longer than 2 minutes to reach. And what they did was, every decision, they showed the action on the screen that the referee was trying to ascertain about whether the ball had crossed the line or not. So you knew, A, what they were looking at. And then when the decision was about to be made, it flashed the screen, decision imminent, and it counted down 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and then the decision came out. I thought that was superb. So you kind of wonder, there, is that something else we can learn from? That maybe you can show the action that's being discussed. And also, the video ref was in the stadium. I think we've said this in this pub for a long, long time. The people making these decisions need to be at the venue to get a feel of what's going on, to understand that. I think when you work in isolation 200 miles away in Stockley Park, I just, to me, that does not seem the right way to go about things as well. And also, the match officials, it was a female referee and a female line judge. And I'm there thinking, well, I'm trying to work out, I don't know how popular rugby league is amongst females, but there's obviously a fast track route there that if you're good at refereeing, the refereeing in a World Cup standard here. And I'm kind of wondering, well, why are there no female Premier League referees? We've got the odd assistant referee on the line, but surely there must be, but they can't be, given the abysmal standards of our Premier League referees, surely some of our female counterparts should be given the chance to show that they are just as good. And final point, the lack of arguing with the officials about decisions. And I love the timekeeping idea. None of this board hold up this 10-minute stoppage time, because there is no stoppage time, because every time the play stops, the clock stops. And so you get the full 40 minutes of action. So I just came on thinking, I don't know about you, Aidan, you there. Did you have a similar kind of experience? Did you share some of my views about it?
Yeah, absolutely. I've been to a couple games and different experiences. One in the big football stadium. So yes, at St. James's Park, that was the opening match of the Rugby League World Cup a couple of weeks ago, England against Samoa. Now, you're talking there about the drinking the beer. So you went to a rugby league ground and did it. This weekend, I've been to another rugby ground, Newcastle Falcons ground, to watch another Rugby League World Cup game with Scotland and Fiji. Again, that's a rugby stadium, and I've been there many, many times and had beer in the stands at that stadium. But to do it at St. James's Park, that's another matter. And that, I have been to Rugby Union World Cup games at St. James's Park as well, so it wasn't a first-time experience. But it does seem odd to be in that stadium with a beer in your hand, in the seat, watching the action. It does, and it's strange. Because, well, I'm a football fan and a rugby fan, and I didn't massively change persona when I go to watch each sport. It is interesting. It's oddly enough, I did a stadium tour at St. James's with my kids in half term just gone. And the lady who was doing the tour was talking about that, because they took us in some of the exec boxes. It was John Joe Shelby's, actually, interestingly enough. But she was talking about there, if the guests in there want to have a beer during the game, they have to shut the blinds, because it's not even that you're in the seats. It's you can't even see the game at all. You have to be watching it on a TV instead. So you can't have a beer whilst in sight of the game, whether you're inside or outside. It's absolutely bizarre. It really, really is. So that, I totally agree with you on that one, Paul. That's something that needs to be reviewed and gone, frankly. I mean, you can do it in other countries. I'm sure you can in Spain, Gary, but in Germany, for instance, I've had beers at football games. Oh, Gary's shaking his head. Okay, I'm wrong. You can't in Spain. In Germany, you certainly can. Maybe that's Germany and beer. Not a problem. Other thing, I agree what you're saying. The subs, it just carries on, doesn't it? But it's a rolling sub, so you can come on and off. That would be an interesting one to bring into football. I don't know how that would work. That one's interesting. But I do like the fact that the physios come on during the action. I think that's something that football should do. And, they come on in a bright, coloured top, so it's really obviously visible. And sure, if there's a really serious injury, everything stops and you get the proper care and attention. But this saves the whole faking injury to stop the game. It probably stops people staying down when it isn't an actual injury, because you're putting your team at a disadvantage, because the game's carrying on around you. Your team is effectively down to 10 men until you're back on your feet and in the action again. I think that would be a brilliant one to bring in. You talk about the VAR. Now, I only noticed this at the second game I went to, which was just this weekend, Scotland at Newcastle Falcons Ground, Kingston Park. There was a captain's challenge as well. So it wasn't just the referee. I hadn't seen this before. So there was a captain's challenge. They get one call to challenge the referee's decision at a certain point. I think there'd been a knock-on or something like that, and it had given the possession back to Fiji, and Scotland were very much on the ropes at this point. So they wanted it changed. They didn't think it was right. They reviewed it. Didn't take very long, and it turns out the referee was right all along. But, you know, that was quite an interesting one. I don't know. It's a bit of a combination of the ways of doing it. So, yes, the referee can ask for it, and the captain can ask for it once, presumably. Maybe it's a bit like in NFL or other sports, or cricket, you get your challenge wrong, you lose it. If you get it right, maybe you get another one. Not sure on that. But that was an interesting one as well. So maybe that's another thing to think of. Speaking of, in the other code of rugby union, and maybe this applies to league as well, I'm not quite so au fait with it. But one thing I love from the rules in rugby union that I think football really, really should do, because I don't think football does this well, is the advantage rule. In rugby, if there's a foul, the referee signals it, holds his arm out. Everyone knows he's given a penalty, equivalent of a free kick, but the play carries on to see if an actual advantage accrues. This can last a minute, sometimes more, depending on how the play goes, until he says, well, advantage over, presumably because you've advanced far enough. In football parlance, maybe you've had a shot on goal. In football, though, a referee plays an advantage and that's it. Your opportunity for the free kick is gone. Maybe you get a few seconds grace and they see just what happens in the quick bit of play and sometimes bring it back, but it's only a few seconds. If they signaled a foul, an advantage, and just let it play out properly, that could take 30 seconds. It could take longer if there's an attack building, maybe a few phases of play, but then they get an effort on goal. Maybe they score. But if they don't, or if no opportunity on goal comes, they lose possession 30 seconds later. They never got a cross in the box. They never got a pass going forward. The referee should then be able to bring it all the way back and say, right, there was no advantage there, back to the free kick. I think that works really, really well in rugby. I would love to see that in football, because I think the advantage law is a horrible one, the way it's played in football. You can easily lose any advantage whatsoever because the referee tried to give you an advantage. Sometimes it works out. I think more often than not, it doesn't. So that would be one I'd like to see. But yeah, I'm all for the beer in the stands. That's the big one. Let's be honest. What do you think, Gary?
I mean, there's so many points there to talk about. We've got to beer in the stands. It's about Surgeon Deltry, which is our local La Liga club, although they're bottom of the league, so they might not be in the Primera much longer. There's bars all around as part of the stadium, in sort of outside the stand before you go into the turnstiles. So you could sit, you could have, five, six, whatever you want. And it, as long as you're not sort of falling over when you get to the turnstiles, you're okay. Inside, you can't buy alcohol. You can't take alcohol in that you bought outside. That's certainly the case at Elche. I'm not sure if that's generally the rule in Spain, but as far as I know, it is. I think what we have to remember is there's a massive difference between rugby league and football financially. Now, I'm not saying this is nice. I'm just saying this is true, that the cheating in football offers greater reward than cheating in rugby league. So players sort of falling down, and I'm not defending it, but players falling down and faking dives and penalties and things, the risk reward ratio is far higher than it is in rugby league. That's not nice, that's just true. The substitutions thing is an interesting one. I mean, we've got these five substitutions now. I mean, it's going to be like they're having a World Cup where you can just bring anybody on. It's going to happen. It's going to happen because it suits the bigger clubs, the more powerful clubs. So therefore, they're going to sort of force that to eventually. Is that a good thing? I don't think it is necessarily. And the sort of roll on, roll off subs, I think it's a different situation. Football's stupid thing to say, Gary. Obvious rule number one, football is different to rugby league. Of course it is. And there tends to be more breaks in the play. So I think that's probably, you know, more, it's easier to do it that way. I'm not saying rolling subs don't work or wouldn't work. It's interesting to think about it, but I'm not sure it's the right way forward. I think we have to be careful about saying, VAR, just talk about VAR. Over in Spain, VAR is much more efficiently used than it is in the UK. I mean, I watch games in Spain. I watch English games as well. A couple of years ago, Stu Horsfield managed to get an interview with Abraham Klein on one of the pods with myself and Stevie. And I asked Abraham about VAR, and he said, and absolutely accurate, if the mistake isn't obvious in 20 seconds, then the decision should be allowed to carry on. I think that's fair enough. The problem we have, you get line decisions, the ball over the line, is it offside? I mean, it's black and white. It's either is offside. People say, well, oh, they should have 10 centimetres leeway. Well, what if it's 10 and a half centimetres? What if it's 11 centimetres? I mean, it's a black and white decision. It's like being, you can't be a little bit dead. You're either dead or you're alive. You're either offside or you're not. The laws of the game define that. Aren't sort of, you know, when it's a judgment decision, like, is it accidental handball or how bad's the free kick? I think if the referee makes a decision and it's not an obvious mistake that you can identify very quickly, then it's not an obvious mistake. So it should stand. But of course,
on that, Gary, just to jump in on that bit, do you not think, though, with VAR, that referees become more reluctant to make those decisions? So if you have this whole 20-second, if you can't see it in there, you stick with the ref's decision. I think a lot of the time the refs just simply aren't making the decision because they know that VAR will correct it. So they'll make no decision, effectively not giving the penalty or something like that, because they know VAR will pick it up. It's their security blanket.
I think that's true, but one of the laws of football is the referee is the sole arbiter of fair play. His decision is final. Now, if he decides then to let the VAR look at it and say, take a look, because VAR does not make decisions other than line decisions. The VAR will sort of say to the referee, take a look at this again, see what you think, or words to that effect. Now, usually they will go with what they say, because usually they're right. But if it's a judgment call, I think that's a difficult decision. And if you say about referees ducking out and making the decision, well, if they know they're not going to be intricately, their decision's not going to be sort of hauled over the coals for 5 minutes analysis, then perhaps they'd be braver to do it. Let's face it, they had to do it before and make decisions. I think with VAR, you know, a lot of people say, oh, it's ruining the game. Well, you know, my simple answer to that is, do you want more decisions right or do you not? And that's perfectly reasonable. If they say, well, no, I'm happy to go with the you know, referees get decisions wrong somewhere. Don't bellyache when a decision goes against you then. That's all I'd say. But VAR is a really contentious issue. Do you want things right or do you want things not right? I don't know. Interesting what Paul says about the sort of countdown on the VAR decision. I mean, it's a bit sort of show business, isn't it? It gives a bit of a build-up to it. I think people ought to be able to know what decision is being debated. It's interesting that there was a classic one last week with the Spurs one when Harry Kane's goal was ruled out. And people on Twitter were saying, how can it be offside if the ball goes backwards? The direction of travel of the ball is irrelevant if you know the laws of the game. If the guy was in front of it, the direction of the ball goes, it's neither here nor there. But there's a lot of people who think, who sort of spout out about decisions in football, who don't really or haven't read the rules. And some of these people haven't read the laws of the game, and some of these people are the guys doing the analysis on TV. Any game can learn from another game, but, you know, I think it's, the problem is that the financial stakes in football are far higher than they are in rugby league or rugby union.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think as well, I share lots of reservations with VAR, but from my experience of, you know, going to games live, and one of the things I hate now about going to football matches, you can't celebrate a goal anymore, because the first thing you do is you look at the screen to see if there's a VAR review. One of the guys I sit next to, whenever we score, he just sits there and says, I don't celebrate now until I find out that it's being confirmed by VAR. And I don't quite know how they get around that, because I agree, they are factual decisions. I mean, in our game against Crystal Palace the other week, the referee flagged for an offside that was nowhere near offside, and VAR confirmed it was the wrong decision and we got the goal. That wouldn't have happened without VAR. So when it makes a correct decision, you're delighted. And I think there's a bit of a rolling thing about VAR at the moment, isn't it? That it's the negative decisions get highlighted every week. Very rarely do the correct decisions get highlighted every week. And the Everton Palace game a week ago Saturday was a classic example of that. It was a blatantly incorrect decision by the official, but VAR overturned it. And that's how it should be used. And I think we all kind of hark back to the World Cup in 2018, when VAR just seemed to be just in the background. And for the Euros in 2021, you weren't waiting 5 minutes for decisions to be made. Going back to what you made there about Abraham Klein, if that was a guiding principle for VAR decisions, that if you can't find a fault with the ref's decision after 20 seconds, then the ref's decision stands. I think that's a really good way forward.
Well, we shall see. If only they'd ask us, everything would be so much better. Well, I'll move us on to another topic then. One I was going to bring up is Champions League related. The failure of two of the Super League, the remaining Super League three. So this is the non-English Super League clubs. So Barcelona and Juventus specifically. I think there's a little bit of pleasure to be had in their demise, I think, for many people watching on. So Barcelona They will finish third. There's a game to go, but they will finish third behind Inter and Bayern. Tough group, sure. But, you know, they've only won one game out of five as we speak, and they're going into the Europa League. Juventus may or may not join them. We don't know yet. But what they won't be doing is going through to the knockout rounds of the Champions League. They're level on points with the massive, the huge Maccabi Haifa as we speak at the bottom of their group. But way, way behind the top two, PSG and Benfica. But Benfica, of course, being the type of European giant that Juventus don't really want to play anymore. And they beat Juventus 4-3, oddly enough. Now, Real Madrid, of course, are the other club that are still part of the Super League, as they like to see. They never quite left it in the way that the English clubs quickly did. Now, they started well. They're going through, but they seem to be stumbling over the line. But, you know, they still managed to draw with Shakhtar and lose to Leipzig, which was quite amusing. But spare a thought for them, though. This is Real Madrid. You know, perhaps they need to drop down to the Europa League as well, and then they might get to play Barcelona and Juventus again, which is what they want to do. So, yeah, instead, poor Real Madrid, they might have to face Brugge or Benfica. This is just wrong. So I think we should send them to the Europa League as well, then they get what they want. Quite pleasing for many fans on a sort of Schadenfreude level, I think. But what I want to sort of talk about it is what it may mean going forwards, because this is what they want to avoid. They don't want this competitive situation where they might miss out. Juventus are struggling, of course, in Serie A as well, domestically. And this is just an extension of their poor form. These three are still members of this Super League, so it hasn't gone. Will this, and this is what I fear, is situations like this season now, the problems they've had reaching the knockout rounds of the Champions League, failing to do so in some cases, will possibly strengthen their resolve? This is the question. Will it strengthen their resolve, I guess, to see through their plans or to rekindle them or to bring them back? I know, obviously, the Champions League is going to soon change to this Swiss format, and there's going to be more, well, I say more opportunity for teams like that as if they need it. But, you know, it's going to make it easier again for them to get through, to remain in the competitions. Securing their passage, their money at the expense of open competition seems to be, you know, the core of their principles. I can only imagine that losing competitively hardens that resolve and makes it more likely that something's going to change again, because obviously their views haven't changed. Juventus still see themselves as the elite, and that they should remain so in their minds, and they shouldn't have to sully themselves playing the likes of Maccabi Haifa or Benfica or whoever else it may be. So yeah, that's my fear, that this situation will reignite it all again. Now, obviously, the English clubs who were involved at that time have had to make various promises, I think, to the Premier League. I don't know how legally binding they all are, but the way they had to quickly about turn and make various, well, assurances, I think, to that they wouldn't withdraw again. So they could only be presumably open to something that was in conjunction with domestic football, not instead of. I don't know how that'll all play out, but I do think situations like this season, if it was to happen again soon, Juventus, if they didn't even make it into the Europa League, that would be a possibility. If Real Madrid get knocked out in the last 16 by Benfica, maybe that'll harden their resolve yet again. I can see this happening, and I don't like it. On a more positive note, the Europa League is going to be quite strong. That's quite interesting. But also, I should confess, you know, I've been a bit of a critic of the Champions League group stages in the past, calling them deathly dull. Well, I don't think you could call that about some of the games that just happened this week gone. Atletico Madrid in particular was quite a spectacular finish to a game. So, you know, fair play. I've been a critic. I'll hold my hands up. There's been some very exciting group games this year, but not that many overall, I wouldn't say. A lot of it has still been two teams way off at the top. Just it's not necessarily the two teams that Juventus and Barcelona would have liked it to have been. So what are your thoughts on all of that?
I think it's interesting with Spain. I mean, Real Madrid are the only Spanish club to actually get through to the knockout stages of the four clubs that went through from the league. And you mentioned Juve. The last five seasons, Juve have been eliminated by Ajax, Lyon, Porto, Villarreal, and they say Benfica. None of those clubs would have been considered to be an appropriate competition for them in the Super League. Man United, who obviously were invited, ain't even qualified for the Champions League. Chelsea lost the first game, drew the second game, went to the third game away to Milan with 3 points on the board and quite likely to go out. I mean, they've recovered, and they're, I think they're guaranteed top spot in the group now. It's really interesting because when you were saying about it first, I thought you were going to say, well, these clubs want to learn the lesson, and I think they should. But it's interesting the take you took on it, that this their failures might actually encourage them to, you know, duck out of the competition in favour of another competition where they haven't got to have these problems with these so-called minnow teams that might humble them. And I think one of the issues that they have about the Super League isn't because they're the best teams. It's because they're the most commercially viable teams. So, you know, Real Madrid playing, Bayern Munich is far more commercially viable than Real Madrid playing Lyon. And that's just fact. It's more sellable, and that's what they're after. It's all about money. It's not about heightened competition. I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, the Super League would be a disaster for football. But it's a fascinating way you sort of phrase the analysis. I mean, I hadn't considered. I hadn't thought that's where you were going with it. But it is a worrying situation that the sort of clubs that are failing, it might actually persuade them to opt out because they don't want to fail anymore against these clubs who the minnows. But that's, you know, that's the beauty of football, isn't it? You know, you can't guarantee success. And, you know, I mean, Barcelona, they were a pretty tough group. I mean, Inter and then Bayern Munich. That's a pretty tough group for any club. But there's lots of, you know, giants to say Juve. They're not even guaranteed a Europa League place. And they're having a terrible season. But yeah,
Barcelona had a tough group, Gary, but they weren't even competitive, were they?
No, they weren't even in it. I mean, in fact, they're having a terrible season. I watched them play last night. They were playing, I want to say Sevilla, but I might be wrong. And it was a 0-0 all the way through. When we were watching on the TV, and I said to the missus, you know, Lewandowski is going to score a late goal and they're going to nick it 1-0. 3 minutes to play, Lewandowski scores a tap-in and they nicked it 1-0. And that's what they've done a lot of this season. He's been their sort of saviour. They've spent a lot of money by all these sort of financial levers that they've pulled. And Rafinha's not playing. He's certainly not starting on a regular basis. Kessie, the sign from Milan, he's wanted to go back to Italy because he's not being selected. And they've got basically not many players that they brought in who are actually played. Lewandowski is the obvious exception. But, I mean, I don't know. They're a strange club in a strange situation at a strange time, Barcelona. But it's a great point you raise,
Yeah, mate, I totally agree with what you and Gary say there. And I think it's been quite interesting watching the conversations and the message coming out from this proposed ESL league in the last 1 or 2 weeks. I mean, they've appointed a chief executive now, haven't they? So they've actually got a name figure heading the organisation up. They've kind of spun it around a bit, haven't they, as to the creating the league to stop the dominance of the Premier League clubs. They're trying to create a rival to the hegemony of Premier League teams, getting all the best TV deals, getting all the best sponsorship deals. So I think they've been quite clever in doing that and kind of, you know, saying, look, we're doing this for the good of football here. The Premier League's too dominant. We're offering a viable alternative. What's wrong with what we're offering here? I also saw something as well. How true this is, I don't know. But there was some talk of asking, you know, inviting Celtic and Rangers to join this proposed league, purely on the fact that TV, as you mentioned, Gary, TV-wise, you know, Celtic playing Real Madrid, Rangers playing Barcelona, is best than Real Madrid playing, you know, Sheriff Tiraspol or someone like that, is it? It's going to attract a huge audience as well. And you kind of wonder, what's the thinking with this? I mean, could we foresee a situation where an alternative ESL starts without any Premier League clubs in it? Could we see a situation where, you know, maybe PSG come on board and join the ESL concept? Could we see a situation where maybe one of the German clubs comes along as well? It's going to be fascinating to see how this develops because these people aren't going to go away. You know, they've invested a lot of money in this setup. They can see, you mentioned the TV rights, Gary. I mean, yeah, I can see a situation whereby if this league took off, you'd have Real playing Barcelona in Miami because they're going to get a fantastic, you know, Hispanic audience watching it there. Remember the Premier League had this Thursday night game concept a few seasons ago. I can see a proposed ESL going down this route where some of the biggest games are taken to Asia where, you know, they're going to get massive TV audience because it's all about the money. That's all they're concerned with. And I know they've gone to the European courts about this, haven't they? And they're kind of making an application on the grounds of restriction of trade. Now, when you take sporting decisions to European courts, you're never quite sure what the outcome's going to be. I think the Bosman ruling has shown that perfectly. You might think this is the outcome, but it might go a different way. Now, I don't know, what if the decision is, yeah, you can set up an ESL, there's no legal impediment to do that. What's the next? It's like watching a game of chess. Is it? How on earth is this going to develop? And I don't mean Aidan, with Newcastle's recent success and with the Champions League place being on the horizon, no, is it beyond the bounds of possibility that Newcastle would be considered for Super League place?
Oh, God. Oh, who knows on that? I guess when it comes to the finances, maybe so. I mean, I guess it was kind of weird on that score that Tottenham were ever part of it as well, because what have they got to show for themselves? Well, they've got a big, spanking, beautiful stadium. And not a lot else. One final place, and then barely turned up for the final, did they? Will Newcastle be a part of it? Who knows? I think it's quite interesting what you're saying there about the English clubs, which goes back to what I was saying at the start there about the assurances they've had to give to the Premier League. So maybe something like this does go ahead without the English clubs. Maybe that's would then be seen as trying to force the hand of the likes of Man City, Man United, Liverpool, and so on, to break their pledges or to do something different. Because if they were then, with the American owners, which I know you've talked about before, Paul, obviously this is their end goal, isn't it? Some sort of closed shop league, American style. If the other European giants went ahead without the English clubs, the Premier League then is weakened in terms of its own selling power, its own marketing. It's, you know, you can't imagine the global TV deals, let alone the domestic. Maybe the domestic would hold up for a bit, but the global ones wouldn't, because as you say, the appeal would be Real Madrid against Juventus, Barcelona against Bayern, or whatever it might be. The hand would therefore be forced on these biggest Premier League clubs to try and force the issue themselves, to try and get in on it. They don't want to miss out on that, and their owners certainly don't want to miss out on that. That would be interesting. But you know, the whole thing, it saddens me. The whole thing, it really does. Money corrupts, and it just makes these things worse. You know, I guess there's a point where, up to a point, it's all okay. And sure, I'm hypocritical as a Newcastle fan on all of this. But I remember as a kid, I read this book about the Olympic Games in the past, in the Greek days, about how, you know, it lasted for hundreds of years and then it all died out because of money, and it was corruption and gambling or whatever, but essentially it was money ruined it all. And I was thinking, oh, well, that wouldn't happen to sport now. Look at it. It's all great. But look at it. Look what's happening. It's ruining it. And it'll get to the point where, so the competitions that we love and enjoy, they have to change every couple of years to satisfy the money people even more. Nothing's stable for very long. And sure, things evolve a little bit. That's always been the case. We haven't always had the European Cup. We haven't always had the World Cup and all of that stuff. But the evolving needs to be slightly more gradual to bring everybody along with it, I think. It all seems to be in such a big hurry to change. And it's like 2 years down the line, we'll have to change the Champions League again. We've got to get the Swiss model format, otherwise we'll end up with the Super League. And then they'll not be happy with that. So we'll have to change it again to keep them happy, otherwise a Super League will happen. And then a Super League will happen. And then they won't be happy with that, because something will be wrong and Arsenal will be bottom of the league and they won't be happy about that. Maybe that's a poor example currently. Maybe Chelsea.
Might be.
People will struggle, won't they? So they'll want it to change again.
Yeah. Two very quick points about the European Super League. Firstly, because when Bayern Munich play Real Madrid, when Barcelona play Juventus, when Man United play PSG, it's rare. If you make it less rare, you make it less valuable. It becomes more ordinary. By definition, it becomes more ordinary. And the other thing is, if you have the best clubs from the top leagues in Europe, so Spain, Italy, England, Germany, France, only one can win it. Only one can win it. Now, these are clubs who are used to winning trophies. Their fans are used to watching teams win things. By definition, only one can win. By definition, if it's 12-club league, some clubs are going to be in the bottom three or four. Now, eventually, the Super League will draw players because it'll be more money. The top clubs will draw the players. And so the clubs who are sort of, and it might be Chelsea, it might be Arsenal, it might be Bayern Munich, who knows, it might be Barcelona, will end up regretting the decision and falling out of the league, because it can't work. Only one can win. And these clubs are successful because they win things. And they can't all win in a league. Only one can win.
Exactly. And that's when they'll want it to change again.
Yeah.
Anyway, who knows? We'll see. We'll see what happens.
Days at school, it's when we say everybody's a winner. Everybody wins.
Well, let's look forward and let's see if we can find something that everybody does win at. Paul, what are you looking ahead to?
Yeah, well, I think I've said in these pods before, the FA Cup is just my favourite competition. To me, it's lost none of its allure, none of its glamour, even more so in the early stages of the competition as well. And it's quite interesting to go back to our ESL conversation and Gary mentioned about only one team can win. The great thing about the FA Cup is, you know, on the day, literally any team can win, no matter what your status is. And the second great thing about it is there's no VAR. So the decisions are made by the match officials. So you accept them or you don't accept them, but they're genuine decisions. And thirdly, for lots of these non-league clubs, you can actually drink a beer when you're watching the game as well. But that's another point. Anyway, but I'm looking at some of the ties for this forthcoming weekend. You've got Hereford against Portsmouth on Friday night. Now, given Hereford's history in the Cup, the fact they went bust and they reformed, they're in the National League North. Why not National League South? I've no idea. But they're playing Portsmouth at the weekend on Friday night. That's covered live on TV. So that's a game full of, you know, you've got Pompey, who themselves won the Cup back in 2008. So there's a really intriguing game there. There's some other fascinating ties coming up. They've got Chippenham Town from Wiltshire playing Lincoln City, who themselves, as a non-league club, did really well in the FA Cup a few seasons ago. Up in your end there, Aidan, South Shields, who I believe are now managed by Kevin Phillips, ex-Sunderland. Yeah, they're playing at home against Forest Green Rangers. They're expecting a sellout there. That's on TV as well. You've got Torquay against Derby County. You've got Milton Keynes Dons playing Taunton Town, who beat Yeovil in the last round to already become Somerset's top football team. You've got Charlton playing Coville Town from the Midlands, probably not too far from where you were from originally, Gary. And you've got Bracknell Town playing Ipswich. There's just a whole range of fascinating games, particularly those, you know, involving ex-league clubs as well, who are trying to get back in. And you've also got no, Cambridge United, who last season got that historic win at Newcastle United.
Had
to get that in, Aidan. This time they start off their cup campaign away at Curzon Ashton, and it's just the way the FA Cup works. They'll probably lose that after the glory of last season. So I just love the first and second round of the FA Cup because there's just so much going on there. And I was kind of looking at the TV coverage because I know from watching Marine that, you know, an FA Cup run can actually transform a non-league club's fortunes in terms of what they can do with the finances. And, you know, over the years, there's been no question that the TV companies have had their favourites who they kind of prioritise for TV coverage. So in about 6-7 years ago, I think it was FC United with all the buzz. They were getting shown for at least 2 or 3 years running their cup run. Then suddenly FC United were kicked off the screens because the Minnows of Salford, backed by millionaires, were suddenly the plucky non-leaguers who were getting covered on the TV. Then they switched to Warrington Town, who became flavour of the month. And then Marine were obviously flavour of the month 1 or 2 seasons ago. And it was quite interesting because last season when Marine got a first-round FA Cup draw at home against Wrexham, they contacted both the BBC and ITV just to check whether there'd be any TV coverage. And they got the curt reply, we think Marine had quite enough publicity from us, don't you? And so they weren't going to cover the game. That was it. your moment in the spotlight was gone. We moved on to a better story somewhere else. And so, yeah, it's the whole thing's just absolutely fascinating. And you kind of look at some of shocks in the FA Cup in the third round or fourth round get massive publicity. When they happen in the first round, they don't get anything like the same level. So, I mean, I was checking back on some of the FA Cup first round upsets. I'd forgotten completely that in 2008, Histon Town had beaten Swindon 1-0 and then went on to beat Leeds in the next round. I'd forgotten as well about, you know, Warrington Town beating Exeter 2-0. Obviously, I remember Marine beating Colchester. One tie I always remember, you know, when I was a teenager from the first round of the FA Cup. And Gary, you may or may not, I'm sure you will remember this, when Brian Clough's Brighton got beat at home 4-0 in the first round of the FA Cup by Walton and Hersham in a replay of the Goldstone Ground, which at the time was a seismic result, you know, that you know, this top-class manager being humbled by this team of amateurs. So, yeah, I just really look forward to the first round of the FA Cup. I'd love South Shields to make some progress because they're only in the Northern Premier League. It'd be great to see them go on a cup run and maybe get the same cap as publicity and support that Marine got last year. Hereford United, I know you might not have the same feelings about them as other people do, Aidan, but they've got such a strong cup tradition. It would just be perfect to see them make another run. And wouldn't it be great if you met them again in the third round? So I just love the fact that all these possibilities are still open. And yeah, I'll be fascinated listening to the scores, kept watching the games on TV. And you know, it's just getting back to, you know,
you
hate to come across and sound like someone who lives the life in black and white, but there's something about these FA Cup games, you know, with terraces, with people standing, you know, with the atmosphere, you know, there's something about it you can't recreate anywhere else. And I just think, it's been the world's longest competition for a reason, because it's a very, very successful format. And it really does annoy me the way so-called teams in the Premier League treat it with disrespect. It annoys me even more the way teams in the Championship treat it with disrespect. But at this level, the first and second round, everything is possible. And it's just, and I've said this before, I really think, what's the reason for the Premier League teams not entering to the third round? Why can't we throw them in the first round? You know, wouldn't you love South Shields against Newcastle as an FA Cup game? You know, it's just to me, seems to be something that you need to look at. But yeah, we're looking forward to these games at the weekend. FA Cup, fantastic competition. Long may it continue.
Oh, I'm intrigued by this. Throw the Premier League clubs in and the Championship ones from the first round. I mean, it's all, obviously they'd have to rejig how all the numbers work and everything, but that's a really interesting shout to see how it would go. But I suspect it would lead to more taking it not seriously, which would be a bit disappointing. You seem to be running through all the teams who've humiliated Newcastle. Over the years.
It's a big list.
Exactly. If I held a grudge against every team that humiliated Newcastle in the cup, I'd be a bitter man.
You're lucky it didn't throw Bedford Town in there as well.
I'm slightly disturbed, as you are, of Hereford being classed as the North. That's just weird.
Oh, it's bizarre, Aidan. It really is, yeah.
But speaking of other teams around this area, Gateshead are in it as well. And they're against another team who've humiliated Newcastle in the cup in the past, Stevenage. So there we go. That's another interesting one. But maybe we'll have a second round of South Shields against Gateshead for the right to play Newcastle or Sunderland in the third round. That would be quite something.
That would be fantastic, wouldn't it? It really was.
But it'd be interesting to see the South Shields one on the TV as well. If you mentioned that's one of the live games. Because it's a galvanized club. I mean, South Shield, we've talked about this before, like a sizable town that's caught between two stools, really. But it's got an identity of its own. I used to work there for my sin, so I know a bit about the people from that part of the world. And yeah, it's a sort of strong identity of its own, but largely forgotten about. So it's kind of, yeah, it's great to have that galvanizing effect on the town itself. Making it better known than just merely for where the Great North Run ends.
It's interesting, you know, with regard to the other rounds of the FA Cup. I mean, there's two things. I mean, firstly, I think I've said quite often that success in football is relative. The result that's, you know, let's say Hereford got against Newcastle is no less important to fans of Hereford than it is when somebody wins the Champions League. That's because that's not feasible. So, you know, it's like saying, well, I can't swim the Atlantic, I might have to swim the Channel. But it's their success. So I think, you know, a non-league club taking down any league club is a massive thing for those fans of that non-league club. So I think, you know, as I say, success is relative, and it's not a lesser thing. It's exactly the same thing. As you've seen your club triumph. The other thing I'd say is, I mean, back in the UK, it's Liverpool, Warsaw. The first two rounds of the FA Cup were one of the extremely rare occasions of Warsaw were considered a giant in a competition, you know, with a playing non-league team. But it was almost like, you're stuck between two stools of thinking, well, I hope you get a non-league team at home, but Christ, I hope you don't get knocked out by them. You know, you almost walk on eggshells for those first two rounds. If you get to the third round, you might draw a big club, and, you know, who knows what might happen then. But I think there's something magical about it. I mean, it seems a bit twee to say it, but I think the first two rounds of the FA Cup are a little bit magical, because you're not only can have the success of a non-league club taking down a league club and becoming giant killers in you know, for their fans, but it's also the dream of what you're going to get next as well. So it allows smaller clubs, not lesser clubs, but smaller clubs, not only to enjoy success, but also dream of better days.
Well, from all this wholesome purity of football, I'm going to take us down a completely different path here with my looking ahead. Yes, I like to bring the doom. I'm actually going to flag a couple of documentaries that are going to be on TV or various platforms coming up. One of which on Netflix is going to be FIFA Uncovered. I think it's a several parter. I'm not sure, but it's as it says on Netflix's own promo about it. It's about football, money, and power. It'll feature good old Sepp Blatter, which we presumably slightly miss now that we've got Infantino. It's going to be a lot about the power struggles. It says revealing. This is what it says: the organization's checkered history. Well, I'm questioning just how much of that it'll actually show, because this is presumably something done with FIFA's approval and say so. Highly dubious. I'm intrigued to watch it, so that's why I'm flagging it. I'm intrigued to watch it because it's going to talk a bit about hosting World Cups and things like that. It's going to have an interest, but I'm a bit dubious, really, as to how revealing it might be. It'll probably be a bit of a soft touch for FIFA. It's not panorama, let's be honest. It's not panorama. But this is a theme where there is so much you can be critical about, so much mud can be flung, and most of it will stick. I'm hopeful that this might just be the sort of appetizer to more explosive documentaries, I guess, coming up over the next few weeks around Qatar, around FIFA, around the World Cup. I think that there is certainly scope for that. I think that there's almost certain to be something BBC ITV related that does what this Netflix program probably won't do and delve much deeper into the murkiness and see what it dregs up from there. But I'm still intrigued to see what this one shows. But more positively on the World Cup theme, there is going to be, this is on Monday night, so I guess maybe by the time this has come out, it'll already happen. But hey, I'm going to flag it anyway. On Channel 4, Italia 90, When Football Changed Forever. I think this is going to be a really interesting one to watch, especially for people of my age and so on. From an English viewpoint, clearly, football didn't change forever for many of the other countries. But from an English viewpoint, this was obviously a watershed moment in terms of English football. If you add into Hillsborough the year before, the changes that were coming, Italia 90 and the England team there fed into all of that. And it did change how things were. It's, you know, we've seen things like the One Night in Turin film based on the All Played Out book and so on. Absolutely fascinating stuff. And I'm absolutely certain this will be equally fascinating to look at and relive all those things again from 32 years ago, which I can barely believe. But on the World Cup theme, I guess I can't be the only one who's struggling to get to kind of appreciate there's actually a World Cup 3 weeks away. It starts 3 weeks today as we record. Less than 3 weeks away by the time people are listening to this. That just feels weird. You know, this should be this time out from a World Cup, and obviously I know why it's different. This is winter, it's Qatar, blah, blah, blah. But this should be the downtime, the domestic stuff. We should have had all our peaks and big finals and all of that's come to an end. And we're now be in that sort of lull, phony war period where there's the preparation. The national teams actually have a chance to prepare. The players have a chance to get together, get to know each other, get the whole team spirit going. There should be a few metatarsals getting fixed. There should be squad selection headaches. But no, we're still in full-on domestic mode, European club mode. It just doesn't feel right. And I find this all a bit sad, to be honest. As a bit of a World Cup aficionado, it just doesn't feel right. And I want to be excited about the World Cup, and I'm sure I will when it actually starts. But I feel like I'm being denied the whole few weeks worth of anticipation that will make it even better. I'm sure I'm not the only one feeling that about it all. It just feels odd that we're just going to suddenly stop domestic football. A few days later, it's the World Cup. They will have the World Cup final. They will have a bit of Christmas dinner, and then there's league football again. It's just not right.
I think you're right.
It's not.
We can delve into some of those themes maybe more when we talk full on World Cup. But I just wanted to flag those documentaries, though. I don't know whether you'll be watching either of those, Paul. You've probably got more chance to than Gary does, given your location.
Yeah, I mean, what you said there about the Netflix one, Aidan, I totally concur with, because I kind of think I'll watch the first episode, but if it's not an in-depth analysis, then I'm not really going to continue with it. If it's just glossing the surface, it's not worth sticking with. However, like you, the Italia 91, I'm absolutely fascinated with. That is why I should definitely be watching. Like you, I've had the Pete Davis book All Played Out. And I think, as you just mentioned, it's 32 years ago, and you kind of forget, you know, the way football was being perceived in the UK at the time, how that competition absolutely changed things. You know, the way Paul Gascoigne's tears are an absolute lasting memory, even if you weren't a football fan. And it just kind of it's almost as if the country fell back in love with football again, because football-wise, it wasn't the best competition. I mean, it was one of the dullest finals ever, the West Germany-Argentina final. But England's unexpected progress to get to that final. I mean, that game is Cameroon, but the balance swung one way and the other throughout the game, and players suddenly come to the fore who maybe seize their opportunities, like Paul Gascoigne, Gary Lineker, David Platt, all these people suddenly delivering quality performances. Yeah, it was just a fascinating competition. The iconic Nessun Dorma intro on the BBC as well, and you can't kind of take a view that there was a real concern beforehand that there was going to be problems with hooliganism. There weren't. English supporters were, you know, were being praised their behaviour throughout the competition. And to me, I kind of remember at the time that I'd never really seen celebrities or recalled celebrities getting involved with football before. Now, you can have a debate whether that's a good or a bad thing. But I remember on the day of the semi-final when we played West Germany and those whole page of Ken Barlow things, let's do it for England. I'm thinking, why the hell's Ken Barlow still supporting England? Like, well, what's going on here? You know, because I just had never been. In the World Cup in 66, there were no celebrities saying, let's get behind England, you know. And that was like a real sea shift in the way it was perceived. And I think the momentum carried on into the following season. And you know, when you think 89-90 football season, finishing the most dramatic of fashions with Arsenal, you know, deservedly winning the title at Anfield. And it then went on to the World Cup in 1990. And it just seemed to be the two meshed together really well. And you know, it definitely changed because I think Thatcher said at the time, they didn't see football as a slum sport played in slum stages, watched by slum people, and that was the perception of football at the time. And the 1990 World Cup changed that completely. So yeah, definitely be watching that one.
Yeah, it totally did. I wonder, Gary, in Spain, do they reminisce in the same way about, I don't know, 2010?
Not so much because they've had more success in recent times. So perhaps not so much. I don't get English. I mean, you can't get English TV over here, but we don't get it. I mean, I have Netflix, but it's Spanish Netflix, so I'm not sure that the FIFA one will be on, but we'll have a look. You know, I mean, FIFA, it always brings a wry smile to my face, you know. The motto is, for the good of the game. Are you having a laugh, guys? Are you having a laugh? Let's be serious.
Depends which game they mean, Gary.
I'll have a look, seriously. I'm the Spanish Netflix, but obviously, that sounds intriguing, especially the Italian 90 one. But as Paul was saying, you know, it's difficult to look back without sort of roasting your glasses, and certainly the Italian 90 was more a triumph of style than substance, shall we say. The production was great, the Nessun Dorma and the stadiums were wonderful, but the football wasn't. There you go. It's interesting because I mean, you mentioned about the World Cup earlier, so when I get to mine, looking forward, I'm going to be looking forward to the World Cup, and not too different from what you were just saying earlier, Aidan.
Well, go for it, Gary.
Okay. I was thinking about this yesterday when we sort of spoke about doing the pod. It's interesting that at the end of a season, when the World Cup, all the issues have been decided. You know, it's going to win the league. It's done. You know, it's going to win the cup. It's done. You know, it's going to win the Champions League or the Europa League or whatever the conference thing is called these days. Now you're in a situation where there's players going to a World Cup from in almost every country, the top three or four clubs will be losing players. Inevitably, certainly, some players will come back injured. And that will upset the balance of that team. Now, I mean, if you're talking, I mean, if Man City, say De Bruyne gets a bad injury, he's had it before, it won't be the first time. That could upset City. Could make a difference between who wins the Premier League. Same thing could happen in Spain. Almost every Real Madrid player is going to the World Cup. Almost all of them. It's going to make a difference because in the middle of the league, in the middle of a domestic season, the World Cup is suddenly this wild card. It's a rock that's been dropped into this puddle. There will be ripples, and people are going to get wet.
Yeah, I absolutely agree, Gary. I mean, it's almost as if. I mean, I think we're all agreed that the time is appalling, isn't it? The World Cup should not be taking place in the middle of the domestic season. It says, I share your concerns about the injuries. I think that the World Cup is going, it'll be the first World Cup ever that's going to have an impact on a league outcome because of the timing, obviously, you know, particularly the injuries to key players. It's almost, to me, as if the league season now, it's in two halves. We'll have the first half up until the World Cup. And then basically what starts after the World Cup, it to me, is almost a completely different competition because it's not just the injuries effect. There's also, I mean, say for argument's sake, you know, England get to a World Cup final and we lose the final in penalties. Then what's the knock-on effect on those players when they come back to play for their teams? They're crestfallen, they're down, the confidence is gone. You know, there's also the issues there as well. So it's going to be... I think is it a two-week gap from when the finals play before the Premier League start together? I know it's a very limited time space.
I don't think it's even that, Paul. I think it's about 8 or 9 days.
Yeah, which is just ridiculous, isn't it? You know, and then, of course, if you support a Premier League team or a Championship team, you've been starved of football for 6 weeks at a time. Well, let's say this time of year is not the best time of year for me. It's so dark, the weather's awful. You know, you want to be, football is something that keeps you going at this time. And you're going to have a situation where when the league resumes, wouldn't it be nicer for the first couple of fixtures they all kicked off at 3 o'clock on a Saturday? Because have you seen some of the timings for the fixtures over Christmas? You know, it's like 8 o'clock on a New Year's Eve, you know, and when you can't travel if you're an away supporter. It just seems to me, you know, that would have been the time to show a bit of consideration for the fan. You've done off football for 6 weeks. I tell you what, for the first two rounds of fixtures, they're all going to be on Saturday at 3 o'clock. But, you know, that's it. No, and that would never happen because of TV. I understand that. But it would have been nice just to have that as a gesture, wouldn't it? But, yeah, I really don't know what impact the World Cup's going to have. And, you know, I hope it doesn't have a negative impact. And I'll probably... Like you said, Aidan, I'll probably end up being drawn into it as the competition progresses, but I really have deep, deep reservations on all sorts of different levels about why this World Cup's being held there this time of year.
Yeah, quite. I mean, I think as soon as it starts, it'll feel like a World Cup again, even though it is odd time of year. It, you know, personally, I think it's going to be weird that it clashes sometimes with school Christmas events and all this kind of stuff. It's just bizarre, isn't it? I think in terms of the injuries and things like that, Gary, and I think you're right. This is going to cause a big impact on some clubs. It's obviously impossible to know who, but some people are going to be very, very unlucky, unfortunate with how it's going to impact them and the rest of their season. It will shape how certain things play out in terms of who goes deep into tournaments, who has a chance of winning them later in the year. Even if it's not apparent from the start, you know, some people might get injured in the World Cup, sure, and then there's the impact directly quite immediate. But somebody who ends up with muscle strains in March or April or May next year, who's played 6 or 7 games in intensity at the World Cup, you know, is that related? Some would argue it might well be. It's not a direct relation, but it's an indirect one. And therefore, you know, it's still all part of the same mix. It's the same story. And therefore, it's really hard to see how it's going to play out. I think I guess there is a possibility for different clubs having a better chance to progress or to push on closer to certain things depending on who they do or don't have at World Cup. I mean, I guess speaking of domestic matters in England, obviously two of our prominent clubs have key players who are not going to the World Cup. So obviously Erling Haaland won't be there. And neither will Mo Salah. Now, I know he hasn't been quite the Mo Salah of the last year or two yet, but maybe this break will actually prompt him back to life and that'll help Liverpool, who, you know, they've been struggling this year. Maybe actually they'll have a much better second half of the season because he's not going to the World Cup. Maybe, maybe not. Erling Haaland probably wouldn't affect him in the slightest anyway because he's a bit of a machine. But yeah, he will have that break. Others, yes, it will be a great opportunity for others to recover from various injuries because they will have a month off or, well, you know, they'll probably go to training camps, warm weather things and so on. But it does give the chance for slight easing off for injuries in certain respects for those who are not going. So I think that the effect is twofold. It's those who are involved and those who are not.
Yeah.
It does make it impossible to know what's going to happen. But I think, and like I say, I think the additional impact of muscular injuries further down the line for those who've had a longer, intense time than they should have had, maybe we'll see some club managers, if they have the luxury to do so, giving people a rest in February for a couple of weeks. Maybe, I don't know. But I guess there's only certain clubs that actually would be in a position to do that.
Yeah, I think it's difficult to foresee, well, it's impossible to foresee what the effect will be, but it's also impossible to say there will be no effect because there's bound to be some consequences to the World Cup being thrust into the middle of a domestic season with nothing being decided. Okay, the Champions League qualification would be decided, but pretty much that's about it. You know, all the domestic leagues and cups and will still be well up for grabs, and the effect of the World Cup will have some consequences on that, for good or ill, for different clubs. Some will gain, some will suffer. We'll see who wins.
It'll be interesting if it's not the usual ones, and if we can actually see some change as a result of it. That would be quite interesting, but we shall see. We've got one other bit of any other business, I think, because we've had a question from John Dolby, haven't we? So it's on a World Cup theme, isn't it? Championship players in a World Cup theme. Any thoughts on those? Now, we've all been frantically Googling. And since I've started speaking, I'm going to steal the first one. Just to make it harder for you. I think, there's one I think is going to be particularly good, but maybe one of you will pick him. I'm going to go for Junior Hoylett, who's Canadian. Because I think it's quite, I like the fact that Canada are in the World Cup for only the second time. And I think Junior Hoylett is quite an exciting player. I think, like many in the Canadian team, that there's several players who are probably better than we'd think when we just think of Canada as a national team. You know, playing in Germany and the likes, you know, there's some good players. But Junior Hoyler, I think, is an interesting one. That I think it's nice for players like that to get this kind of recognition that they'll get by going to a World Cup and hopefully performing well. So, yeah, he's one I wanted to flag because I'm particularly intrigued by how Canada are going to get on in the World Cup. Hopefully not as poorly as they did in 1986, but we will see. So having stolen him, who wants to pick another one?
I'll go with that. That's okay. That's okay with you, Gary. Yeah, I'm going to go for Josh Sargent of Norwich, mainly because, you know, he's playing for the US. The US are in our group. I remember watching him in the Premier League last season, and I wasn't overly impressed, to be honest. But from what I've seen in the Championship this season, he suddenly found the Midas touch in front of goal. He's been a real threat for Norwich, scored lots of goals for them this season. He's probably quite rivaling than Pouke for the number of goals he managed to bag for the team this season. So I think he's going to be one to keep an eye on. He's, you know, very athletic player. He suddenly, you know, he quite often gets into goal scoring opportunities. And I think, you know, England would be wise not to underestimate the goal scoring threat he would bring to the US team if he's a starter in that side as well. So Josh Sargent is one for me to watch out for, definitely.
Which leaves everybody else for you, Gary.
Okay, that's fine. When I saw what John asked, John's question actually was, which Championship player do you think will have the biggest impact in the World Cup? So what my sort of approach was, not who's the best player, but who could do the most to help their team progress. And I think Canada will struggle to get into their group, given the fact they've got Belgium, Morocco and Croatia in there. Not that Junior Hoyler isn't a decent player, you know, he'll do well for Canada. And Josh Sargent certainly got a chance of the USA progressing. But I've gone to the group that's got Qatar, Ecuador, Senegal and Netherlands in, because I've gone with Ismaïla Sarr, who 18 months ago, was massively touted by so many big clubs in Liverpool were very much interested in him. That it went away, and he's scored 28 goals in 100 league games for Watford. He scored 10 goals in 47 games for Senegal. And I think this guy could actually get Senegal out of the groups and into the next stage. So to me, he's the guy who can make the biggest impact. I was interested when I looked at the sort of, and the squad hasn't even been finalised yet, so it's a bit all up in the air. But there's about 10, a dozen players who'll be playing for Wales or in the Welsh group, through the Welsh squad, who are playing in Championship football. Oh, I didn't know that. And some more than decent players in that group. So, you know, you could go, I mean, people like Joe Allen, who's playing at Swansea, and you know, a couple of years ago, there you go, this guy's played for Liverpool. You know, he's not a bad player. But I will definitely go with Ismaïla Sarr, because I think he could have, you know, to use John's phrase, he could have the biggest impact.
That's a great show, Gary, that really is. Yeah. Definitely agree with you on that one.
He's probably, yes, the one who's got the best chance of going far. I think John will probably be disappointed we haven't mentioned any Sheffield United players. I'm sure that's what he was angling at. So I'll just give an extra shout out for Ndai. I think he's probably one that has a chance again with Senegal.
Adam Davies.
To progress, and he's a blade, and that's probably what John was hoping for. So there you go, John, that's one for you. There's a couple of Welsh players from Sheffield United too, but they're, again, yeah, less likely to progress. Anyway, let's wrap things up there for tonight then. Thanks both for your contributions again. Cheers, Gary. Cheers, Paul.
Terrific.
Thanks, Ed. Enjoy
it. Thanks always.
Again. Yeah, brilliant conversation. So many topics covered in such detail. Yeah, loved every second of it. Thank you.
Brilliant, and thank you, everybody.
Before we go, I read someone on Twitter today said it was called a podcast, and he says, most podcasts sound like just some blokes down the pub talking about football. To me, that's a compliment. I think that's how it should be. I think that's something that we tend to do, and I think it works well. So cheers.
That's what we aim for. That's what we aim for. Oh, yeah. It's pleasing if we hit that mark. Yes, we don't want to be fully knowledgeable. We want to sound like people just ranting away in the dark. That's what it should be. Excellent. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening as well. We hope you enjoyed it. And please do join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with these Football Times. Thank you and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.